Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today's program encores a conversation with biologist and ecologist Jim Bodkin. This conversation first aired on Nature Now in May 2016. Jim is a retired research wildlife biologist who worked for many years in Alaska, where one of his focal study areas was the biology of sea otters. But before we go to sea otters, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Wasn't that a wonderfully rich and musical song? The maker is quite common in our local woods and neighborhoods. We'll come back later in the program and identify this critter. Also in our woods, wildflowers are popping up during these late spring and early summer days. One of the strangest of the perennial wildflowers are the coral root orchids. Although rather hardy and somewhat common in deciduous, conifer, and mixed forests, these wildflowers always seem rather exotic to me. Coral root orchids spend most of their time underground, emerging only to flower and reproduce. Basically leafless and rootless, they're very subtly colored, and their stalks can appear somewhat stiff and a bit contorted, rather like sea corals. To me, the most interesting thing about coral root orchids is how they make a living and the complex interrelations that are needed between several different species. So, coral root orchids produce little or many produce no chlorophyll, and so they do not photosynthesize as a source of their energy. Instead, coral roots obtain the nutrients, minerals, and water they need to survive by parasitizing mycorrhizal fungi. Then the fungi have a symbiotic relationship with a photosynthesizing plant, and those plants supply the mycorrhizal fungi with energy-rich materials, while the fungi contribute water and minerals to the photosynthesizing plants. Wonderfully complex. So we've got the non-photosynthesizing coral root orchids, the fungi, and the photosynthetic plants. A good place to look for coral root orchids is in the leaf molds and duff along the trails in Old Fort Townsend. The two species you're most likely to see are the spotted coral root and the Pacific coral root. The differences in coloration between the species from one population to another within the same species, even within a single population, is due to the interplay between a number of factors that includes not only genetic variation, but also the presence and uptake of various different metal ions in the soil, other specific soil and environmental conditions, and the particular type of mycorrhizal fungi being parasitized. For the spotted coral root orchids, there are at least six known different color varieties that are all due to the fact that these different groups parasitize distinctly different fungi species. And if you look at the narrative descriptions of our two common species, they're frustratingly similar. Both the Pacific coral root and the spotted coral root orchid can grow to a height of, as much as 2 feet. The stalk or scape of the spotted coral root can be yellowish brown, reddish brown, or reddish purple. Whereas the scape of the Pacific coral root is described as a red to brownish purple. Not much difference. Both species can produce as many as 40 small, intricate orchid-shaped flowers on a single scape. And the flowers of both species are variously colored, usually reddish to purplish or lavender, or even pure yellow and green. So the best clue here is consult a plant guide for clues on how to tell the difference. Just for the curiosity factor, coral root orchids were used by indigenous peoples for colds and bronchial irritation, sometimes coughs, and they were used as a root tea to strengthen the blood, all around good medicinal. One last note, look but don't take. As with all orchids, illegal collection, attempts at transplantation, and loss of habitat have reduced their numbers. Coral root orchids, like the many other species of orchids, have really special requirements, as you can tell by the fungi, photosynthetic plant kind of relationship. So it makes them extremely difficult to cultivate, and they just simply do not survive when they've been transplanted from the wild. Well, as I mentioned earlier, today's program is an encore. The original conversation aired in May 2016 and was one of a series of four conversations about sea otters that I had with Jim Bodkin for Nature Now. I suppose I picked that encore because today, we're recording this program on June 8th, is recognized by the United Nations as World Oceans Day. So, in recognition of World Ocean Days, here is a discussion about the biology of sea otters.
Earlier this spring, I attended a great presentation on sea otters that Jim Bodkin gave to the volunteers at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. And I immediately knew that I just had to invite him to talk with us on Nature Now. Jim recently retired to Port Townsend after a long and very impressive career with the federal government as a research wildlife biologist in Alaska with the U.S. Geological Survey. Jim's focus was, and probably still is, isn't it, on population biology, the ecology of marine mammals, especially sea otters, coastal marine ecology, and marine conservation. Jim has a long and very impressive list of scientific publications, but what really impressed me about the presentation Jim gave to the Marine Science Center volunteers was how he organized his talk and told the story to really drive home some very basic concepts about sea otter biology, their survival, and marine ecology. So welcome to Nature Now, Jim.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
First, let's be clear. We are talking about sea otters, a marine mammal, not river otters, those pesky critters we see locally on docks and decks of boats and in the bluffs. We are talking about sea otters. Just briefly remind and distinguish for our listeners the difference between a river otter and a sea otter.
There's 13 different species of otters around the world. And most of those occur in the low latitudes, and nearly all of them occur in freshwater systems.
Like the river otters that I knew growing up in the Midwest.
Right, right. Although the river otters in Puget Sound and elsewhere along the coastal areas where they live often occupy saltwater, and they'll live in marine habitats, and they'll feed in marine habitats, but they typically rest and do all of their other activities ashore. Or in freshwater, so they'll access both freshwater and sea.
So they're not really marine mammals.
Not exclusively,
yeah.
Although you'll certainly see them
in
the marine environments.
Yeah.
Probably the biggest difference between the river otters and the sea otters has to do with their size and their feeding habitats. The sea otter is the largest of all the otters. The largest one we've ever weighed was 112 pounds, and it was captured off the coast of Washington.
That's a hefty size.
Right. Well, that's nearly four times the weight of an average river otter. And they're nearly a meter and a half long. They're quite a bit larger. And probably the easiest way to tell them apart in the ocean is that the sea otter will often be found resting or feeding on its back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's consuming almost exclusively large marine invertebrates, things like crabs and snails, urchins and things like
mm-hmm.
that. But they're very similar in appearance, and they can be very difficult to distinguish.
So now that we're clear that we are going to talk about sea otters, where are they found? I, of course, have that iconic image that many of us have of photographs of sea otters off the California coast or in the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which has an endlessly fascinating exhibit. Tell us about sort of the range of the sea otter that we know around here.
Sure. So the sea otter is confined presently exclusively to the North Pacific Ocean. And it ranges from the northern islands of Japan, across the Aleutian Archipelago, through Russia, and through northern Alaska, and then down the west coast of North America to essentially, historically, central Baja California. And so that's kind of its range. And within that range, it occupies almost all nearshore marine habitats. We don't know of any types of nearshore marine habitats where they don't occur, but they are limited in their offshore distribution to their ability to dive to the bottom to get food. Because they feed on benthic invertebrates, animals that live on the seafloor, they have to be able to dive to the bottom to get their food. And their ability to dive is limited to about 100 meters or a little over 300
feet.
So
that's near shore or around islands.
Exclusively and, near shore, right.
Not the open ocean.
Although they can be seen many miles offshore when shallow water occurs offshore.
Okay.
There's places up in the Bering Sea where we might find otters 50 or even 80 miles offshore.
So let's talk a bit about kind of basic survival issues. The marine environment, as you know, can be pretty harsh. It's wet, cold, salty. How have the sea otters adapted to just to living in that kind of an environment?
They exhibit a number of different kind of adaptations from other otters that they're most closely related to that's more common to marine mammals. And in particular, they give birth to a single young. So all of the marine mammals give birth to a single young. All of the otters, except for the sea otter, give birth to multiple young. So one of their adaptations to living in the ocean is a single birth. Another major adaptation is the development of their fur. They have the densest and by most regards the finest fur in the animal kingdom. And they use that fur as their insulation so that they can occupy cold waters. That fur is what kind of precipitated their harvest. So they don't have any blubber like all of the other marine mammals.
Like the whales and the dolphins.
Right. And the pinnipeds. And so they use that fur exclusively for their thermal regulation.
That's interesting. No fat layer.
They have no subcutaneous fat or very little.
Well, I mean, we all have fat layers, but not a...
They don't use it as insulation, right?
Now, I'm thinking about that fur for a minute, thinking about as a pinniped, there was an elephant seal in town a few years ago. There have been several that come ashore for sort of their spectacular molt. Do the sea otters do that?
The sea otters don't annually molt. They molt continuously.
So, a lot of the fur critters we know.
Right. It's a kind of an adaptation that's a throwback to their phylogeny, to their history. All of the otters have kind of a continual molting period.
So the next kind of area of questions is what do they eat and how do they find their food?
They have a very diverse diet. We've recorded over 100 different species of prey items that they consume, but they're generally classified according to the types of habitats that they occupy. So in soft sediment habitats, things like sand and gravel or cobble, they're going to rely to a large extent on infaunal bivalves, things like clams primarily, but also worms. And on rocky substrate, they're going to eat things like urchins and crabs.
And they use their hands a lot, don't they, when they feed, rather than you think of sea lions really using their teeth?
They're fairly unique in the animal kingdom in that they've developed a capacity to use tools. So they will actually use stones as either anvils or as hammers to open hard shell prey, things like snails or abalones and clams even. Some of the harder shell preys.
How do they get an abalone off the rock? I mean, I used to free dive for abalone off California, and it's a challenge.
Right.
How do they do it?
They do it with brute strength in most cases, but they will also use a tool underwater. So they'll break a shell underwater to basically get an animal off the rock. Abalone have a refuge in that if they can occur in a certain type of crevice that the otter can't get into, they can persist in those. It's really the exposed abalones that are kind of most vulnerable to predation by sea otters.
The Marine Science Center has a skull of a sea otter, and in looking at it, it is so impressive to me. I mean, the size of the nasal cavity is gigantic. And if you look in there, you can see really complex internal bone structures. What's that about?
It's, again, one of the adaptations that the sea otter in particular has. And it's really a way for them to see their environment. We tend to view the world through our eyes.
Right.
But sea otters and a large number of other animals have different means to view their world. And the sea otter relies heavily on the sense of smell. Yeah. It's largely how they detect other sea otters and how they communicate with one another. There's a ritualized greeting that takes place whenever an otter swims into a group, and they'll go from animal to animal. They'll thoroughly investigate them with their nose.
And they are, they're mustelids.
They're mustelids.
So related to weasels and skunks, other sorts of and skunks
badgers,
and
yeah,
things that smell, and some things smell badly. Another thing when I think about sea otters, I know they have a huge role as a sort of a keystone species and an important role in the ecology of kelp beds. Can you talk just a little bit about that part?
One of the attributes of sea otters is that they, one of their preferred prey items is the urchin, the sea urchin that occurs, well, throughout the world's oceans. When the urchins are reproductive, they have a very high caloric value to the sea otters. But the sea urchin is also a grazer.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of analogous to maybe a sheep, if you will, in a terrestrial system.
Yeah, they just sort of chomp along on kelp and other algae.
Right, the urchin
algae,
is a grazer. And in the absence of sea otters, when there's not this predation pressure, these urchins can grow in abundance and in size, and they can essentially deforest the seafloor from any kind of algae. So there's a kind of an absence of primary production in the system when sea otters are absent and when urchins are abundant. But as sea otters have recolonized much of their habitat in the North Pacific, they've essentially reduced the urchins down to very small numbers and to very small sizes so that this grazing effect is removed. And this allows the kelp forests to flourish. There's a huge amount of primary production in the system, which...
And a habitat for lots of other critters.
Right, habitat and nutrition that finds its way up through the food chains. And we're doing some work now that just basically determines that most of the primary production in the nearshore system, even fishes that occupy a pelagic food web position, much of their carbon, and in fact, most of, in many cases, most of it is coming from kelps as opposed to coming from phytoplankton. So it really is an important role that otters play in many different respects related to kelp forests and nearshore ecology.
Thinking like an otter for a moment, if I were an otter, what would I be worried about in terms of predators, and what would I do to keep from being eaten?
You potentially have a large number of predators.
Even though it's such a high keystone feeder itself.
Right. One of the things that you do as an otter is you don't go ashore very often, or you don't go ashore where predators are going to be available. And those would be terrestrial predators, things like lions or bears or wolves. And that's why we don't see sea otters very often hauled out or coming ashore. Now, there's also a few marine predators that they have to worry about. Probably the most common one that we see throughout the otter's range is the eagle. The eagle is really only capable of preying on sea otter pups, newborn sea otter pups. So the female sea otter, when she has a newborn pup, which weighs somewhere around a few pounds, she will change her behavior. So she'll feed only at night because she has to leave her pup alone while she goes. Dives to the sea floor.
Because he'll stay at the surface.
He stays at the surface. So he's vulnerable to predation at that time. So mom will modify her behavior so she feeds more at night, and she feeds more in shallow water where the pup is left alone for a shorter period of time. The eagle is a predator, but only on a certain age and size of animal, and only probably for a few weeks before the juvenile sea otter learns to dive. And then there's sharks. There's a number of white sharks in particular in California have recently been recognized, although they've been known to be a predator on sea otters for a long time. It seems fairly evident now that their white shark predation is kind of limiting the northern expansion of sea otters up in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Interesting. Well, I know that I could talk just forever with you, but I do have just a couple other questions. Again, thinking like a sea otter, I need to reproduce. Tell me a little bit about that. Where do they mate? You already mentioned they only had one pup. Are they territorial?
They have a polygynous reproductive system where males occupy and defend against other males' habitat. And pretty much most of their range is divided up by these territories that a single male will occupy. And he will try to sequester females within his area. But the female is free to move from one territory mm-hmm. to the other in general. So there's some choice by the female there. These territories are held for multiple years. They can be held for many years by the same adult male. The adult female, she matures at 3 to 4 years of age. She gives birth to a single pup annually. She is pregnant or gestating for 6 months, and she has a dependent pup for about 6 months as well. So there's an annual reproductive cycle.
Okay.
And the adult female is either gestating or lactating throughout her life.
And her life is about how long?
It's upwards of over 20 years. There's animals, the oldest animal that we know about is 27 years old in captivity, and we know of animals in the wild that have lived to be about 20 years old.
Okay. So I have one last question to ask you, and this sort of gets generated by the thinking about reproduction. The iconic image of sea otters are these sort of cute, playful, photogenic, sociable critters, and the visions of them in rafts kind of off the California coast is what I have. Are they really social? Do they have a social structure? Is knowledge passed down through teaching and learning? What's their social life like?
Yeah, they have a really complex and kind of social system. You might even view it as a culture. So within these territories that I described, there's preferred resting areas, and females will, and the associated male will occupy those on a daily basis for years. And these home ranges might be as small as a few square kilometers.
Not big.
An annual home range, right? So it's very small, and it's the same group of animals that live in these relatively small areas. And they interact with each other on a daily basis. So it's difficult to imagine that there isn't some communication.
Right,
we know that there's
right.
different types of communications.
There's vocalization going on.
There's vocalizations that take place. And we do know that at least the food habits of the individuals are transmitted from mother to offspring.
So teaching and learning.
If mom feeds on crabs and urchins, if that's her specialization, that it's most likely that her pup will have that same type of diet.
Yeah. I think we could just talk for a really long time, but I think we need to wrap up this part one of our interview with Jim Podgan. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, that was kind of fun. So looking forward, what's coming up? This week, Friday afternoon's Nature in Your Neighborhood discussion explores more about shrubs with Brian Rott, and the virtual Nature Walk features herbaceous plants with Coca Sanchez and Dana Eckelberger. They are two great plant naturalists. I've been on a couple of walks with both of them. Learn more about the Nature in Your Neighborhood program and possibly sign up to participate by going to the Jefferson Land Trust website. Now, let's hear that mystery sound again. The famous ornithologist Roger Torrey Peterson, the author of many really important guidebooks, described the maker of this boisterous and extroverted song as a sparrow dipped in raspberry juice. I certainly can do no better, except to perhaps suggest red wine instead of raspberry juice. It is the purple finch, a common woodland and backyard bird of our area. And yes, it is not purple. The species name of the purple finch is purpureus. It comes from the Latin and means crimson or other reddish color. Our English word purple, which is a color obtained from mixing red and blue, derives from that same Latin word. Hence the sort of slight confusion about the purple finch is not really purple, it's crimson. And the only other bird that we're likely to see around here that could meet that description of sparrow dipped in raspberry juice is the house finch. The two birds do share a number of similarities. The house finch is invasive. It was imported into the East Coast and has spread west. But careful observation, time, and a good guidebook can help folks learn how to distinguish the two. Also, the Audubon website has a great little article about how to identify the field marks in the house finch compared to the purple finch. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays after the community resources and calendar. And then there are repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5 p.m. after the local news and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening. Today's ending music is called The California Sea Otter by the Banana Slug String Band.
Diving to the bottom where the food is found, lying in the kelp bed when the sun goes down, twisting and a turning, spinning all around. You know that you're the ocean clown, California sea otter. You're the ocean clown, California sea otter. You're the ocean clown. There you are, floating on your back.
There you are, floating on your back.
With that rock on your chest, you give that clam a crack. Spin around, dive back down, and then
spin around, dive down, and then
you're back to your back with a whack, smack, snack again. Nighttime comes, you're fluffing up your fur. Your pups on your belly, snug, warm, and secure. Wrap yourself in kelp, and you will be in the cradle of the rocking sea. California sea otter. Just fooling around. You once were hunted for that fur of yours. I'm glad you've come back home to these safe shores. Let's go swim and surf out in the sea. Bottom where the food is found, lying in the kelp bed when the sun goes down, twisting and a turning, spinning all around. Know that you're the ocean clown, California sea otter. You're the ocean clown, California sea otter. Just fooling around. Whirling, twirling, whirling, twirling sea otter. California sea otter. You're the ocean clown. California sea otter. Just fooling around. You're the ocean clown. Just fooling around. You're the ocean clown. Just fooling around.